Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
It's Stagwaddy game. I'm going to go first.
Go
Shall
on.
I go first? Because this one is nominated by a listener, by Phil Porter, who sent in the suggestion. And you haven't seen this, and I've tinkered with it a tiny little bit. But anyway.
Go on, try me.
The thing about Stagwaddy game is you kind of have to know your opponent, really, a bit.
It has to be tailored, doesn't
it's
it?
It's got to be a
to
bit
the
tailored.
Opposition. Yeah.
Anyway, Phil had the splendid idea of rock stars and their dogs, okay?
Oh, that's good. But
rock
that's
stars
good.
And dogs is such a good idea.
That's
okay.
Great.
Here come five, and one of them's not real.
All right, go on.
Lady Gaga has a dog called Asia.
Yep.
Neil Young had a dog called Rover.
Yep.
Beyonce had a dog called Munchie. Pink had a
so
dog
plausible.
Called... Pink yep. had a dog called Elvis.
Yep.
50 Cent had a dog called Oprah. Okay.
Oh, those are great. Rover, I'm fairly sure, is real. I'm fairly sure that's real. And it's kind of arch and ironic, isn't it? Beyonce's Munchie is brilliant. That's exactly what she called a dog. As is Elvis from Pink. Lady Gaga's Asia. That's, yes, opera. That's a tricky one. It's between Lady Gaga and 50 Cent.
And you're going to choose one?
I'm going to say that Asia is the made-up name.
Not true.
Okay, go on.
Lady Gaga has a bulldog called Asia. Beyonce has a Shih Tzu called Munchie. Pink has a bulldog called Elvis. 50 Cent has a Schnauzer called Oprah. But Neil Young does not have a dog.
Oh, right, okay. Oh, I've completely fished in. That's really good.
I fished you in.
It's plausible. It's utterly plausible.
So well done to Phil Porter for sending.
I got one from Patrick Crowther, another listener actually, Patrick Crowther in Lucha. In Tuscany, which I thought was really good. And I'm going to launch this one at you, Dave. Cool. This is five Nigerian high life musicians.
Oh,
okay. It's good. It's good. One of these isn't real. Dr. Sir Warrior. Ebenezer Opie.
That's real.
Fat Eye Rolling Dollar. How good are they? Flavor Nabania.
Oh, good grief.
And Triple G. Oh, I'll give you those again. Dr. Yes. Sir Warrior, Ebenezer Obie, Fat Eye Rolling Dollar, Flavor Nabania, and Triple G.
I've no
They're great,
idea.
Though, aren't they wonderful names?
Ebenezer Obie, I know is real. Fat Eye Rolling Dollar, I'm going to pick.
Okay, no, he's real. The great man is real. No, the one that's made up is Triple G, which is, in fact, a Nigerian manufacturer of computer stationery. That's really good, isn't it?
Very good. Well,
thank you one? Very much to Patrick Crowe. That's brilliant. Anybody thanks. Listening who's got a stat waddy up their sleeve, please send them in. They're really, really funny.
That's a really good...
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Did you see? I don't know if you saw this yesterday. That Tony Glover, who was one of Bob Dylan's old mates from university days back in Minnesota. Was he?
Yeah, I remember talking to him, yeah.
He died last year, and his widow has just sold his treasury of Dylan. Well, it's more than memorabilia. I mean, this is extraordinary stuff. You know, handwritten letters from 1964-65. In real detailed letters, you know, and long taped conversations from various points in his career. She's just, there's been sold at auction for, I think it's just under $500,000. I don't know if the market for that kind of stuff is slightly down at the moment or up. I've no idea at all. But it's really interesting because it makes you think of that period you know, pre-fame Bob Dylan, when all those guys all met at the University of Minnesota, and there was Tony Glover, and there was Paul Nelson, who was the guy who went on to be a kind of A&R man and was involved with Rod Stewart and David Bowie and all sorts of people. But, you know, there was obviously a group of those guys who were into all that stuff, and one of them became Bob Dylan, which is just, you know, which then affects the lives of all the other ones who were not Bob Dylan, doesn't Completely. It? For the rest of their lives, you know. And I think he probably maintained very good relations with them, you know, and he certainly gave Tony Glover a lot of his time. And I thought it was really exceptional, because normally in those situations, normally when you have those little teenage or childhood or student groups, the one who dies is the rock star.
Yeah.
And the ones who live to a ripe old age are the ones who
eat health food and jogging and generally looking after themselves. And if you think how Dylan caned it in his youth. And just, here he is about to be 80, isn't he? Amazing.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
So it just made me wonder whether I've got $500,000 worth of correspondence from a rock star or anything like that that I ought to tell my wife about for when I turn my toes up.
Turn your toes up.
That she could go down the auction house. Have you got anything like that?
God, I don't think I have really. No, I've got a few autographs up in the roof. I've got a Michael Jackson autograph somewhere. But yeah. I mean, are these things really worth a lot of money? Probably not. You know, well, the thing for me is, I wonder how Dylan felt about that, because there must be part of you that thinks, oh, that, you know, very private letter I wrote to him, then I'd like to keep private. But then there's probably another part of you that thinks that's so great that my old pal, assuming they still have a cordial relationship, is going to his family is going to get some money out of it. No, exactly. Yeah. The family going to get some money out of it.
Well, the widow is no doubt thinking, well, I don't know what to do with it. You know, probably, I don't know, what would you do in these cases? You go to the estate, you go to Bob Dylan and say, do you want these? Do you want to buy them off me?
Yes, that's true.
Otherwise, or you find an academic buyer or a library or somebody like that. That could use them. So
it's difficult to know whether she got a good deal or she didn't, because the quantity of the stuff, we haven't read it, but it really interests me, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, letters from anybody famous that have any indication of their character, if they're formal letters and don't reveal much about them, they're not really worth very much. But if they have some indication of what they're like and what they're thinking, some idea of their characteristics at the time, they've got a huge value.
These have a lot of material in them. There's a big piece in Rolling Stone about them, which is quite interesting. I recommend it to any Dylan fans. I'm sure they found it. They found it already.
Did you follow the George Clooney story?
Well, this
that's
is
related, it. Isn't it? George Clooney. Amazing. There's a piece in GQ. Really good piece. Interviewing George Clooney, and he reveals that in, I think it was 2013 or whatever it was, soon after the film Gravity had come out. And he was in Gravity. I don't know if you've ever seen it. It was a bit of a kind of risky kind of cult thing, and they never thought it was going to be successful. And so they didn't give him the standard fee. They gave him a kind of royalty, a percentage. And, of course, it was a huge success, so he made a lot of money out of it. And what he decided to do was he had, I think it was 12 or 14, I think it was 14 old pals who looked after him. And George Clooney wasn't successful till quite late on. I mean, he didn't really come into the frame till maybe in his 30s, I think. So he spent a lot of time kind of bumming around. He said he was sleeping on people's sofas and borrowing money off them. And they were just his really good mates. He always wanted to pay them back. And he decided what he was going to do was to give them each $1 million in cash. $1 million in cash. So he found out how you do this. There was a warehouse that could supply the $1 million. He got two security guys. They rented a van, a florist's van, so it wouldn't draw any attention to itself. Went down to this warehouse and these people forklifted pallets with the allotments of $1 million. We drove them up to his house. He invited all these guys around for lunch and then announced that he'd got this cash. I just couldn't think. I didn't know what I felt about that, because, I mean, obviously it's fantastic. It's great that he gave him the money, but also it's unnecessarily flash, isn't it? And also it's a bit awkward to be given that in cash. I mean,
it is, yes.
Then go home in your car with $1 million in the boot, trembling all the way.
It's a movie. It really is a movie in itself, that it is, isn't it?
You know, it is.
the gift. Because how many? 14 guys.
14 guys.
And they're all guys, are they?
Yeah, okay. Bunch, yeah.
I'm wondering if one of them, when he went home, didn't tell his wife.
Oh, God, that's good. Oh,
it's just got to be one of them, hasn't there?
Yeah, just sorting something, just carrying something to the garage. Be with you in a minute. Yeah, spends it all on booze and gambling.
I'm suggesting...
But it's cash. It is cash,
I'm going to go further with this, Mark. So one of them doesn't tell his wife. One of them doesn't go home at all. What if they've just...
Out of 14, it is a movie.
Out of 14, you know what I mean?
It is a movie.
It is a movie. One of them takes George aside afterwards or rings later and says, this is very generous of you. But actually, if you remember, I did a lot more for you than Fred over there.
Yeah.
You stayed on my couch. And by the way, you slept with my girlfriend. Let me just bring that up, which he will have done.
Yeah, so that's another $30,000. Yeah.
And so I think I should get slightly more than the rest. You know,
That's true.
I can't believe that 14 people walk away from a thing like that going, well, that's fair.
That's great. Absolutely fair.
That makes no change to our relationship. You know what I mean?
Outside of those 14, there's going to be another half dozen who also put him up and, you know, fed him and lent him money and didn't get anything at all.
Absolutely.
So how can you win in these circumstances?
You can't at all. No. I mean, he could have given it to charity in their names or something like that. I don't know. Also, the first thought I had, you know, because anybody who studied the career of singing nun, as I have done, knows that the danger of this is you give away all your money from a huge, great windfall hit, and then the tax man comes
back to bite you in the arse.
It's because you've got to pay the tax on
a nasty show. She got a huge tax bill, didn't she? Which led to terrible circumstances.
Oh, she was terrible. She'd given away all the money, and then the Belgian tax authorities, whoever it was,
said,
you owe us, you know, half of this, this huge, great windfall.
One of my favourite tales of this kind of philanthropy is Kimberly Rue of the Waves, who I think you interviewed for Word, didn't you, around this time? Kimberly Rue, who wrote, Going Down to Liverpool, Walking on Sunshine, Love, Shine a Light. You have real big hits, huge hits that were used in movies. Sold his catalogue. Well, I mean, he'd done very well out of it anyway. He sold his catalogue to BMG, I think, about, 10 years ago or something. And then I think either gave the other three members of the Waves a cut in the songwriting royalty, or he just gave them a lump sum. But it was a really sweet thing to have done.
It ended up being a lump sum. But he did. He cut them in. The big hit was Walking on Sunshine, which still gets turned out on movies and commercials all the time. And he basically said, okay, I'm going to cut you in for part of the publishing, the other members who made it, because effectively for 20 years what they did was they managed the revenue from that one song. And so they re-recorded the song in their 40s, I think.
That's right.
Agonizingly, painstakingly, to make it sound just like the original one, so that when anybody came along and wanted to use the song in a commercial, they said, fine, but you've got to use our version, because then they got the publishing and they got the record and they got the recording revenue. And so, later on, they sold it to BMG for a significant sum of money, which they all participate in it. And that's great. You know,
really lovely. It's lovely. Well, do you think how many instances there must have been of people sitting in a room with the person who got the songwriting royalty, songwriting credit, chipping in with a chord sequence or a lyric or an idea or something, and then feeling aggrieved afterwards that they didn't get any recognition? You know, The Band is a really good example. All those songs have been written by Robbie Robertson. And there's four other people who contributed to their arrangements and indeed sang them. You know, and it's their stamp, it's their signature that makes those songs so fantastic. But he's the guy who wrote the songs.
But I think it still remains the case, it seems to me, that musicians enter the music business without really knowing that whoever wrote the songs is going to make six times as much as you make. And that's going to be a problem at some point down the road.
Oh, God, absolutely.
Unless you do an REM.
Unless you do an REM or a U2 or a Blur or whatever, yeah. You all get a credit. And that's great. So, you know, so Adam Clayton makes, I think, about a fifth of whatever it is that they make collectively in U2. And that's fair enough. And that's presumably why the band's still together. One of the reasons, anyway.
It was definitely. It's definitely the case.
What's your statistic about the Beatles? You've got some amazing statistic about Love Me Do.
You can see it in Mark Lewisohn's first book about the Beatles. I think it's a footnote. So many of the wonderful things in Mark Lewisohn's books are in the footnotes. I don't know if they're very often things he got to know quite late in the day or something. But I think I'm busking off the top of my head for the figures. But I think Love Me Do, Beatles' first single, not a huge hit, but a hit. And obviously only in the UK. I think their royalties as recording artists for the four of them were like £25 each.
Yeah.
They got. But the royalties to John and Paul for writing the song were something like £350. So on that, something like that.
Yeah.
On that basis, you would get seven times as much for writing the song as for being one of the four musicians who played on it. And so it's possible that you take that rule of thumb and still apply it today. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That if you've got your name on the songwriting credit, that's worth far more. And also, it goes on way longer, doesn't it?
Andrew Ridgeley is a great example. Andrew Ridgeley has, I think he's got two credits. One, I think, is Last Christmas, and I can't remember which the other one is now. But George Michael very sweetly just gave him half a credit. And I think he's pretty much been able to do it. I mean, maybe he lives with a member of Bananarama who probably gets some kind of royalties from something or other. But I mean, I don't think he's had to, you know, struggle since. So you can live on half a credit of a reasonably big song for the rest of your life.
And if you have a big song, like a Christmas song, like, you know, we're once more entering Noddy Holder season.
Yeah.
And Noddy just thinks, oh, it'll continue to roll in, you know, because are the two of them have got a credit on Merry Christmas, Everybody? Noddy Holder and Jim Lee.
Jimmy Lee, the bass player, that's right.
Whereas Don Powell and Dave Hill.
Were until lockdown. They're still slogging away in Slade 2, weren't they?
Probably.
God, that must cause tension, must it?
Yeah.
My God, can you imagine?
So talking of Christmas records, then I noticed...
Pogues. Come on.
It's this time of year again where the question of... people worry about whether they can play the Pogues' Fairy Tale of New York on the radio. And this year, the BBC have come up with a kind of, how would we describe it? A kind of tripartite solution, haven't they, here? That they've...
Well, they're allowing the Radio 1 can only play the edited version, where instead of you scumbag, you maggot, you cheap, lousy faggot. I think it's you're cheap and you're haggard. It's a version she re-recorded. She re-recorded a kind of edited version in 92, so that's the Kirsty MacColl vocal. And I think the you're an old slut on junk line has either been erased or bleeped or somehow the word slut doesn't kind of appear. So that's the thing. Radio 2 can play the original and Six Music can decide. It's up to the DJs. It's such a good story. There's so many interesting bits of this story. One, I think, was that the fragrant Lawrence Fox tweeted his some very aggressive thing about the BBC's censorship. And he was kind of, you know, thoroughly shooed by the band, wasn't he, for doing so, which I thought was quite interesting because, of course, the band are in favour of being edited. What would they rather have, that the record wasn't played at all on Radio 1 or that they played an edited version?
It's an
weird situation where you've got the people who wrote the song attacking the bloke who wanted to hear the original. It's amazing, really.
It's interesting that... you know, she obviously she died in 2000, I think.
Yeah.
Round about this time of year, wasn't it?
It was.
So my God, it's 20 years ago.
Yeah.
By God, can we just pause one second to say, Kirsty MacColl, my God, she was good.
Real talent, amazing talent.
And extraordinary talent.
And also, not only just a fantastic singer, but tremendous warm and funny, you know, personality. And what she, I'd love to know what she'd think about all this. She'd have a very, she's very strongly opinionated. So.
Well, yeah, so she re-recorded it in 1992 for Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
And you kind, you know, like, remember the famous case of Ray Davis crossed the Atlantic to re-record.
Cherry Cola.
To replace the words Coca-Cola with Cherry Cola on,
that's right,
on Lola. And, but I mean, certainly in 1992, even then, Top of the Pop still had extraordinary power. And so if the difference, if, you know, if all you had to do was change a few words to get on Top of the Pops, everybody would have changed a few words, wouldn't they, to get on Top of the Pops, because you kind of had no choice. Whereas nowadays, you know, it strikes me life's very different, really. And, you know, I cannot believe the Radio 1, which is supposed to be, which they're always telling us is the edgy station that the 15-year-olds are all listening to. I cannot believe that Radio 1 even needs a policy on whether to play Fairy Tale of New York, which was made in, what, mid-'80s?
Yeah.
You know, all these years later. It's like Radio 1 in 1976 having to decide whether it's going to play White Christmas. It's,
but
it's,
aren't they just working back from the idea of a controversy? You know, they're just trying to avoid any kind of... any kind of lynch mobs on social media. You know, if one person was to complain about it, they would have to defend it, but they wouldn't want to have to defend it. So it's like, it's like, it's like Round the Horn. There was an episode of Round the Horn that was repeated in February, and one person complained that it was racist, and they had to issue a sort of an apology, I think, saying it was a breach of policy. So that it's very, very difficult for them. But I do think it's amazing that the indication is that, the implication rather, is that it's the teenagers who are more sensitive and more easily outraged than the Radio 2 listeners, which is that, true.
But it also it turns the whole thing on its head, you know, that kind of it used to be disgusted of Tunbridge Wells, didn't it?
And it is.
It was always some colonel with a monocle who was getting red in the face because something he'd just heard on the radio. Now it's, you know, kind of disappointed of Stoke Newington, isn't it?
It's
19-year-old.
I know.
It's just absolutely switch around. But here's my, I mean, generally speaking, I don't think it's a good idea to go back and bowdlerize lyrics, you know, because "You're cheap and you're haggard," you know, it's just not as good a line as "You cheap, lousy faggot." It's just
nowhere near
as good a line. And this is supposed to be, at some level, art, isn't it? So art will involve occasionally controversial language. It's a fact. It's going to have to do.
It
Otherwise,
is.
It's going to get really boring if it doesn't.
Yeah, so, whether that's movies or books or whatever.
Absolutely.
This is the generation that grew up with Tarantino movies.
Yes.
You know, and there's all sorts of words.
So they're not shocked by anything.
Not shocked by any of that.
They've just decided what to be shocked by.
Well, I suppose this has got a kind of LGBT kind of dimension.
Well,
to
obviously,
it,
obviously,
word, you know,
obviously, but, and that was the kind of the dimension that it was in when it was used initially. You know, it was supposed to be a term of abuse. And but here's my point: I don't think you should change the words of songs or records.
Yeah.
But if something bothers you, I've got a radical solution: don't play it.
Don't play it.
Just don't play it.
Yeah.
How about that? There are millions of bloody records. You can play something else instead. If it really bothers you, don't play it. How's about that? You don't have to do it, you know. So,
is there a panel at Radio 1 that decides? Does somebody go, "Delilah, do we play that? Brown Sugar Under My Thumb. Yeah. Hey, Joe. Kissing Cousins by Elvis Presley." Well, I've got a gal. She's as cute as she can be. She's a distant cousin, but she's not too distant with me. I don't know. I don't know if you'd play. Would you play that? I don't know if you would. "Tonight's the Night," "Walk on the Wild Side." I don't know.
No.
Somebody must be making decisions about it, mustn't it?
It's all post-social media, isn't it? That you have to avoid the storm in a teacup, don't you? That inevitably follows, you know. It always amuses me when people talk about the newspaper reports on these things. So-and-so took to social media. They always say that. I'm just going off now to take to social media. That's right. You know, I'll put the cat among the pigeons.
This'll learn them.
So really, it's all the newspapers blowing up whatever happens in social media, which has been the case
for quite a while, hasn't it?
I suppose so.
We know this is a news story that's already happening, so let's report it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll keep a weather eye out for that. But meanwhile, the fairy tale of New York is the second best Christmas record ever made, isn't it? Oh, God, Lord,
it's an absolute work of genius.
It is.
I think it's probably the best. You're suggesting here the wonderful Z Records. What was it? Dave, I've forgotten his name now.
David Sigerson.
That's right.
It's a big country. We should have to do a list of the second best. I always think it'd make a good chart. The second best Christmas records ever made. Don't choose the best one because, you know, it's kind of obvious, you know, I don't know. But second best is more interesting, isn't it?
It is.
Makes a more interesting list. So if anybody's got any suggestions
for
the second best Christmas record ever made, send them in time for Christmas.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Okay, we're back, joined by Alex Gold. How are you doing, Alex?
Good. I'm all right.
It's a podcast. You can't put your thumbs up.
Schoolboy error.
Schoolboy error. Did you see that? Well, I only didn't see it on Friday night, but I've caught up with it since. This Jazz 625 thing on BBC Four. On Friday night.
You're exclusively watching Marvel programmes.
Oh, yes, of course you are.
Your busy schedule of sci-fi. That's right.
Yes, you're doing... Of course, Alex has been doing the Marvel Universe, which is about, I don't know, about 30 films or something
And the series as well.
Then you've been doing them in actual chronological order according to the chronology of the drama. Is that the case?
So there's a whole universe, the whole Marvel Universe, and I'm doing it, so you can do it in many orders, and the order I'm doing it is the chronology of the Marvel Universe. So not necessarily release order. So no. Like a sub-series that goes back and discovers the origin of a character, I do that. So last night I finished watching the 22nd episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Series 1. And it's great.
It's a daily thing, is it? So every day you're
completely committed.
More of it.
Absolutely, that's I'm all in. Tonight it's.
But Jay, it's funny you should mention this because Lucas Hare, who's a friend of the pod, who's involved in the excellent Bob Dylan podcast. Is it Rolling Bob? He's obviously at a loose end during lockdown. He's come up with a playlist on Spotify, because Spotify has pretty much everything Bob Dylan ever recorded, which includes all the kind of bootleg series and all that stuff that's come
out
latterly.
Actually, just a quick tangent. I also listened to last night the first ever Bob Dylan album for the first time ever, because I'm going through your Oversexed playlist.
Oh, right. Well, there you go.
That's really good.
I sat and I listened and it was great. I really enjoyed it.
Well, anyway.
Well, you can now go back to his early stuff, his pre-recording stuff.
Because what Lucas has done is put together all the Bob Dylan music on Spotify in the order that he recorded it, which is not necessarily the same as the order in which he released it. Because
so this is stuff from the 50s, isn't it? Late 50s it starts, presumably?
Well, early 60s possibly. I don't know. Right through. So you suddenly get a live track in the middle of a kind of, I don't know, recording desire or whatever. He does, you know, some gig or something or some bootleg or whatever. And it just struck me with a catalogue like Bob Dylan with so much stuff. You can do it in all kinds of different ways. You can't you? You can shuffle it endlessly, you know. You could probably make a list of 100 song Bob Dylan songs that are based on real life events or something like that, couldn't you? It's just there for you to play with. So you could do your own
theme time radio hour about Dylan himself, couldn't you? Precisely.
You could.
And he gets the
Friday night Jazz 625 thing, which is certainly worth catching up with, is obviously on the BBC iPlayer, is reflective of an upsurge of kind of talent and interest and excitement around British jazz kind of, well, are they jazz musicians? I don't know. They're certainly very informed by jazz and certainly schooled that way or whatever. Playing this very open, exciting, warm, inviting music, which are not normally adjectives that you might associate with jazz. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
It's very uncomplicated stuff. It's quite conventional, actually, isn't it?
Okay, but it's just...
It's avant-garde.
No, not really. But it's very warm and inviting. And I first learned about this about a year ago. I met Nick Logan at a party. Nick Logan, our old colleague on Smash Hits and The Enemy, and Nick...
Who launched the face.
And all sorts of things. And so Nick, kind of original mod from the 60s, really. And he was telling me about this, that he'd been going to a series of these gigs, and they tended to be very often in old churches, because they were the only spaces that could accommodate the large, you know, number of people who wanted to go. And also the fact that these artists liked to perform in the round, so you needed a big space in the middle rather than a stage. Yeah. And I thought, when Nick was talking to me about it, and Nick was really animated about it, I thought the same as I thought watching this thing this weekend, which is, this is terrific. What it needs is a name.
It does. I'm amazed it hasn't got one, because the press, maybe the thing's just not so dependent on the press, but when you were dependent on the press, it was the music press that drove everything, you immediately had to call it New Wave, or you had to call it
New Romantic.
New Romantic. You had to come up with a name.
Yeah, yeah.
Why isn't it called New Jazz? N-U Jazz.
Well,
or New Note, Dave. New Note. Blue Jam. New Jam. New Jam. How about Jam Today?
You see, I think it needs a name, and I think there's an interesting debate about whether that name should involve the jazz word or not.
We've got acid jazz. Why not warm jazz?
Yeah, it's just... it doesn't get you excited.
No.
It doesn't make you think, God, that sounds like fun. Whereas if you go and watch that program and you listen to it, it sounds like it is fun. It's terrific, man.
You said it's really.
It's infectious. You know, it's kind of. It needs some word, some adjective that doesn't involve a musical reference. Even it probably ought to get away from that. I'm not suggesting we should come up with the answer here. I'm just saying it made me think.
New Romantics gave you no idea what it sounded like. It only gave you an idea what it looked like.
It just didn't matter, though, because that just, it ticked the box, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It did.
So it made the, you know, it made the idea travel.
Yeah.
It made it so that, you know, all these years later, Dylan Jones can write a book about, you know what I mean?
It's true.
Romantics. Whereas... if that word had never come along, you would have to write a book about stuff that happened in Britain in the early 80s. It's not the same, is it?
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's certainly worth seeing. Alex, you used to, among your many previous manners, you used to live in Muswell Hill, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I used to be a hillbilly, for sure. I loved it there. It was great.
Yeah. And you used to go to Toff's Fish and Chip Shop.
Toss was me local. Only the chips, though.
Only the chips.
And kind of the V.
Did you ever pass? You probably did, I think. They used to a music shop called the Les Aldrich Music Center. You probably went in there to buy guitar strings and things like that.
I did, actually. That was my regular string stop. And capos, which I always lose, and, you know, everything
like that. Well, I've lived around that kind of area for a long, long time. And I've found myself thinking of the last 10 years, you know, I think the Les Aldrich Music Center, which I remember as a place that always sold musical instruments, always sold sheet music, but also sold records and then sold CDs. I thought, is this the last record shop in North London?
Of course, they have records as well. Yeah.
Well, but I put this to our mutual friend, Paul Kramer, who used to run a record shop in North London. He said, well, they don't really sell records anymore. And I had a look on the website, and they don't really. I mean, they probably sell a few, but it's mainly musical instruments, whatever.
Yeah.
So that left me thinking, and I've been thinking about it all weekend, are there no record shops left in the whole of North London? Because we... And are there any?
Do you mean from a particular era or just generally?
Well, I don't know. You're probably going. I mean, I don't. If I wanted to buy a record, and I'm living in N14, and I wanted to set off to buy a record from where I am. Now I know it's locked down and all that, so it's exceptional circumstances. How far would I have to go?
I'd
have to go an awful long way. And I'm in London. I'm going to have to go in the West End.
Yeah, you'd go to Sisteray in Soho or somewhere like that, wouldn't you? That's
I suppose so. Well, yeah. I mean, because, you know, HMV's gone from the West End, obviously. They, you know, the chain still operates in other parts of the country.
I don't see HMV as a music store anymore. I just don't make the association in my head. I view it as a place to buy get games or band T-shirts, but I wouldn't go there to buy music.
So I'm particularly thinking about this at this time of year, you know, as we get into the festive season, because I used to work in a record shop, and it was all about Christmas. You know, if you had a good Christmas, that tied you up.
It's like the publishing world.
Yeah, it really was. You know,
yeah.
Christmas revolved around suddenly the store was way fuller than it would be even on its busiest days. And in and amongst the people who were buying records to, you know, that they always wanted would be a succession of very often slightly bewildered looking older
aunts
women.
And uncles. Buying record tokens.
It would come in, well, either for record tokens or they'd come in
a list.
Bit of paper. You know, have you ever heard of this before? You know, and so you'd have to give them the, you know, Blue Oyster Cult and Steely Dan and God knows what they wanted for their nephew and whatever, because presents were such a huge part of the music business. Gone, totally gone. And so it really brought home to me the record shop. I mean, which has never been more celebrated in fiction and myth and film than it is now.
Completely.
There's never been less represented on the ground. Now, I know there are odd exceptions. I understand that. And it's interesting. You should talk about Sister Ray as where you'd go. You know, like that would be the main destination in the West End. Well, it wouldn't have been 30, 40 years ago. There would have been about 50 different places you could have gone, you know.
Well, I used to work in a record shop in Stratford-upon-Avon when I was just out of school, and it was V Shop, and it got taken over by Sanity, which is then the kind of the Australian HMV. But we had HMV across the road. We used to do that Wild West thing where we used to sort of stare at each other outside the door every morning. Just sell more CDs than you today.
Stand up, yeah.
But it was really easy to find a place that sold records. They were just everywhere.
Yeah.
And now they're nowhere. It's really
bizarre. Now it's gone completely the other way. And when you think about London, which is, you know, where Mark and I live, and you're not there at the moment, but, you know, you normally spend a lot of time there. Yeah. And, you know, people say, because I tweeted this, I said, can anybody think of a record shop in North London that would have been there in the early 70s? And people scratched around, and there was the odd suggestion, but nobody was very sure. And then people said, well, you won't find any shops that would have been there in the early 70s, you know, which I understand retail landscapes massively change. But I started
untrue. There's lots of them.
Well, if you look, particularly in the West End of London, particularly in the centre of London. So now I know the world of bookshops has massively changed, but Foyles is still there, but you know, but these are big destination bookshops. Hatchards in Piccadilly,
Stamford's,
the specialty traveller map shop, Haywood Hill in Mayfair is still there, and those are probably just a few of them. If you think about food shops, Fortnum's is obviously still there; has been there since the 18th century.
Yeah, it was in the 1700s, wasn't it? Incredible.
Paxton, do you know, Alex? I thought you, with your vegan hat on, might know Paxton and Whitfield. Do you know Paxton and Whitfield?
No, tell me.
They are London's longest running cheese business.
Oh, really?
Yes. So, you know, when this bloody war is over and, you know, you can come back into the capital, you'd be able to go and gorge yourself at Paxton Whitfield.
Lock and Co. Hatters, hasn't that been there since, oh, since 1765 or something? It was founded in 1675.
I was given a hat from there only a few years ago.
Because if you go to Lock and Co., you can be reminded that Lord Nelson and Oscar Wilde would have been in the same shop and bought hats there. Well, that's pretty good, isn't it?
They've got the, if you go into Lock and Co., and they're a lovely, lovely shop. And very often, if you go into these places in St. James's, which is where they tend to be, you know, they're always, you know, the oldest shirt maker or whatever. They tend to be very welcoming, you know, because they know that their job is to kind of sell their brand and sell their history. And I think if you go into Lock & Co., they have the hat, whatever you call the equivalent of a shoemaker's last, the shape of a head.
Yeah,
they've got the hat, the shape for like Charlie Chaplin and Lawrence of Arabia and all these kind of people who were once clients of theirs. So that's been going for years.
And lovely old umbrella shop. Is that a beautiful umbrella shop in Hobart? Fabulous.
Well, this is it, James Smith, the umbrella shop.
Yeah.
If you can now, I know rain has never gone away in London, and I know an umbrella is never going to be something you're going to buy online, but if you can keep a fabulous umbrella shop going in the West End of London, why the hell can't somebody keep one fabulous record shop going that draws tourists and visitors to the centre of town? That's the thing that I find amazing. I mean, I know loads of record shops are probably going to go out of business, but I would have thought that it would have been two or three prestige survivors.
But half the problem is just the width of the catalogue, isn't it? I mean, I don't know, can you always guarantee that? I mean, I totally agree with you, but can you guarantee to have something? An umbrella's an umbrella, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what kind of records do you stock? But it's interesting, at a tangent, it just struck me that were there any items that completely went out of the frame? The video cassette is one, I think, possibly. It's almost gone now, the video cassette, isn't it? I mean, you can't really play it. You can't even get the machines to play it. So you think of the great era of Blockbuster. So there were video shops everywhere, and the DVD shops, kind of that's disappearing, isn't it?
DVDs,
you know, you don't see any watch menders really. You don't see so many cobblers. You don't see any camera shops. You know,
CD, I would wager CD players are going out as well. I noticed actually not so long ago that I don't have a CD player anymore anywhere.
Well, mine has started misfiring after I've had a long time, and I've decided I'm going to have to replace it.
But also, computers are being made without CD drives.
Yeah, they are.
We got my sister a DVD for Christmas last year, and I could see by the expression on her face, which was she was trying to kind of look upbeat about it. I suddenly realised she doesn't have a DVD player. She's got nothing she can play it on. So she's just being polite. I know.
So in my survey of shops that remain in London, do you know, you'll walk past this place loads of times, Mark. I certainly had done, but I hadn't been in there until about a year or so ago. Do you know Arthur Beale, which is...
Yes.
You do know it, do you?
Yeah, I do know it, yeah.
It's opposite Endeavour House where...
It's a Chandler's, isn't it?
It's a Ship's Chandler's.
Now, that Arthur Beale was founded something like 500 years ago.
They can trace it back to some kind of business.
It wasn't that actual shop, but yeah.
Making ropes 500 years ago.
Isn't that amazing?
And do you know why they're there? I think this is why they're there. Because my son-in-law works in the theatre and the film business. And he told me he had to go there. And he says, it's on the edge of Covent Garden. I said, why the hell should a Ship's Chandler be on the edge of Covent Garden? You know, it's a place you can go in and buy an anchor, probably, you know, and also think for life on the ocean wave. And he said, the reason is that they also supply all the ropes and pulleys and all the devices that you use backstage in the theatre business.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
Which is perfectly makes sense, you know what I mean?
They would be right smack in the heart of it, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah. It's all, you know, it's the same technology involved in backstage at a theatre as involved in an ocean-going yacht. I'd never thought of that before. So I went in there with my wife as a teacher who wanted a piece of rope that she could demonstrate knots to children on. So we went into Arthur Beale and were able to find one. So if Arthur Beale can still sustain a business in the West End of London, somebody should be doing something similar to the record shop.
Do you remember in Stella Street, they had a wonderful episode where they had a chandlering shop run by Keith and Mick? Do you remember that? Yes, it's called Some Like It Yacht for all your chandlering needs. So Mick Jagger had taken up. The Stones had gone bust and he was now working in the shop.
Yeah. So what else we got to talk about? Any other business, Alex? We got to do
together? Documenting the best music books for 2020, haven't we?
We have.
That's right.
We've chosen our 10.
Our top 10.
And we're
plugging each of them individually. They're really good. What a great year it's been for music books. Fabulous. Yeah.
So it might be the kind of thing you want to point a generous relative in the direction of to make sure all your Christmas present needs are taken care of. Anything else we got to say?
We've also upgraded the quiz.
Oh, God. Yes.
We've definitely mentioned that.
Yes. Well, as in with added pork pie, do you mean?
Well, yeah, two things going on in Quizland. One is we've gone all pictorial, which appears to have gone down well.
Indeed.
Albeit involving me and more work, but anyway. and the other thing is by the very kind officers of Sarah Pettigrew of Brace Cottage, excellent pork pies, were able to offer a prize for our end of the year winner of the quiz. Yeah. So this is a person who's at the head of our leaderboard as we go into Christmas, that there will be a very special pork pie winging its way. If pork pies wing, yes.
It's going to wing its way
to you in time for Christmas. So, you know, it may be too late for you to get your name among the leaders, but you might like to join for future reference. You know, if you're a Patreon supporter, you're in a position to do that. And if you want to know more about Patreon, just go to patreon.com/word in your ear and all the details are there. Is that all?
I believe it is.
I think we're there. I think we've cracked it.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.